If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm your host, Ed Newcomer, and today our guest is former Fish and Wildlife Special Agent Steve Stawinski, coming to us from his home in Wyoming. Steve has a lot of prior experience as a wildlife law enforcement officer, having worked for the states of both Wisconsin and Utah. As an agent with us, he spent with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He spent time assigned to duty stations in Colorado, Wisconsin, Alaska, and Wyoming. Steve, welcome to the show. I appreciate you being on. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Ed. Good to see you again.
Hey, listen, you. I know you served in the U.S. Army for a while before you went to college. You were airborne, right?
No, they didn't. I didn't sign up that long.
What'd you do in the Army?
My job was a combat engineer. So,
Okay.
Frontline demolitions and things like that.
Very cool. Very cool. But after your service, you went to Southern Illinois University, where I think you actually designed your own major. Isn't that right?
That's correct. I started there in forestry, and quickly learned that was the study of growing and cutting trees down. And they had convinced me to take that major, but my goal all along was to be a game warden, a wildlife officer. And I realized that wasn't the best academic vehicle for it. So luckily I had a professor who was my counselor in forestry, and he had worked for the refuge system for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And I told him what I wanted to do, and he suggested that I probably should switch degrees and go into wildlife management or criminal justice. And I'm like, I wanted to be a game warden. A biologist was narrow and a cop was narrow.
Right.
And then we came upon this special major program that Southern Illinois offered. And with him and the help of two other professors from wildlife management and criminal justice, we designed a four-year degree specifically for conservation officers. And we called it conservation law enforcement. So at graduation, it was kind of lonely. I was the only student in the row for that program, but it was a neat academic vehicle because I got to combine the disciplines of forestry, what I had, criminal justice, wildlife management, public relations, and then criminal law. It was a cool degree, so I had a lot of fun.
That's awesome, and you know, I think it shows, you know, how committed you were to this career, even before you became, you know, a state officer. Even in college, you were looking to, you know, educate yourself about how can I get the best education to become the best wildlife law enforcement officer I can, which is, that's pretty phenomenal. I teach here at California State University at Dominguez Hills, and I teach criminal justice. And I know it always strikes me that there's, of course, wildlife crime is just like any other crime. So criminal justice courses work, but there's so many unique aspects to being a wildlife law enforcement officer that a specific major specifically designed for people that want to pursue that career is a pretty valuable thing. That's kudos to you for putting that together. That's pretty cool.
Oh, thanks for saying so. It stuck out when I applied for jobs, that's for sure. So
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet. And is that something that the university continued after you left? I mean, could other people go to Southern Illinois University and pursue that degree?
A great question. After I left, and I'd been in the field for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, I got a call from the criminal justice department, and they asked me how it worked out. And I said, fantastic, actually. And they said, let me tell you this part. When I tried to get the major set up, the criminal justice folks were kind of like opposed to me doing this because they wanted to declare me as their student.
Right, of course.
So I went to the dean of the school that the criminal justice department was housed in. He was an avid fisherman. And I told him what I wanted to do. And these guys were roadblocking me at criminal justice. And he says, I got a bigger bulldozer than they do, were his exact words. He says, we're going to add this to the curriculum here at Southern Illinois. So they did. So it was added to the school catalog. And when I got a call 3 or 4 years later, asking me how it was going and did it help, would I change anything? And when I asked why, he says, because we've got about 20 students enrolled in that program. I'm still waiting to meet somebody who actually did that degree, though. I haven't run into that person yet. So I always ask people when I meet them at, like when I was working or even now, where they went to school. I'm always hoping to find that SIU grad that had the same degree I did. So
that is so cool. You'll find them. Eventually you'll find them, I'm sure. Maybe through this podcast, somebody that went through that program will hear it and reach out to me and I'll put you guys in touch.
That'd be great.
That would be cool. I just think that's awesome. I've often thought about trying to develop specific courses, focusing on wildlife crime or wildlife criminal procedure or something similar to that. So you and I need to talk more offline, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You spent some time as a state officer for different states, and that the titles are always different. So as our listeners know, you know, a lot of our guests on this show are former special agents with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, so federal agents. But we have had, and we will have, some state wildlife officers on. And, you know, the easiest way to explain the difference is a state wildlife officer, whether the title is conservation officer, wildlife officer, conservation warden, or game warden, they're basically the state police for that state that focuses on wildlife crime. And, you know, the easiest way to explain the relationship between them and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is to compare it to, say, you know, the state police in some whatever state with the FBI. It's kind of the relationship. Does that kind of jive with your understanding?
I think you got it right on there.
Yeah. And you were you worked in Wisconsin as a state officer for a while. How many years did you do that?
I had 6 in Utah. I was only there in Wisconsin for less than a half a year because I got picked up by the feds and that.
For some reason, I thought you were Wisconsin first, then Utah, then the feds, but it was the reverse. You were Utah, Wisconsin, and then U.S. Fish and Wildlife hired you, right?
That's correct.
Okay. I don't know why I had that reversed. It's another interesting aspect to being a federal agent is the cutoff age to become a federal agent is 37. You have to enter the Federal Academy Honor before your 37th birthday. But at the same time, most federal law enforcement agencies do not hire people straight out of college. It's pretty rare. They want you to have a demonstrated professional resume before they'll hire you. So it ends up kind of a narrow window. How old were you when you got hired? I just made it. I was 37, almost 37.
I was right behind you. There was, I had applied a couple times and got told that very thing that you just said that, you know, get more experience, but keep applying because it's such a competitive job. So, I just turned 33 when I got hired.
Yeah. So, you know, like you, I applied multiple times before I got an interview to be a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service special agent. So you're kind of like biting your fingernails. Like, oh my gosh. Because between like federal hiring freezes and just the fact that they don't hire new agents every year, you're always kind of biting your nails like, am I going to make it? Right.
Yeah. Right. To that note, you know, one of the first conservation officers I met in Illinois, I'd asked him if I, you know, what I would have to do to be a conservation officer. And my mom was in the kitchen there. He was doing an investigation on a taxidermist and he came to talk to us about our records. So my mom's like, my son would love to be a game warden. You know, what does he have to do? And he looked at my mom and he looked at me. I was about 16 or 17. He said, well, ma'am, do you have any political connections? And my mom's like, well, no. And he looks at me, he says, hey kid, forget it. You're never going to get that job unless you got some politicians helping you.
Wow.
I was deflated. And after I got out of the Army, I'd gotten a scholarship from the state of Illinois as a veteran. And I showed it to my dad when he came home from work. And my folks were blue collar people, you know, didn't go to college. And I showed my dad this letter and he says, you're going to take advantage of this, I hope. I said, I don't know what I do. He goes, well, you always want to be a game warden. I said, well, remember that game warden said, you need to know some politicians and like one in a million people get the job. And he got mad and he's 55 and he got out of his chair, sat next to me on the couch, put his arm around me. He said, you know, every dad thinks this of their son, I'm sure. You're one in a million. Why don't you just try and see what happens? Here I am talking to you how many years later as a retired federal game warden. So anybody who's out there listening, and if they're interested in this profession, don't let anybody tell you different. It can be done. So
yeah,
this is fantastic.
You know what? That is 100% my experience as well. I'm not shy about telling people. I applied four times to be a Fish and Wildlife Special Agent before I even got an interview. And there were a lot of people that were like, you know, I was a lawyer at the time, and they're like, you're a lawyer, you're not going to be a federal wildlife law enforcement officer. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to try my hardest. You know, you don't give up. And if something interests you, you just keep at it until the right people see your resume and see the passion that you have for the job, right? No matter what the job is.
And I think in part too, it just shows that deep commitment of people like yourself that really want to be here to do something for the resource. And that's what the resource needs, people to champion them. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, whatever profession you're in, but in particular, I think public service, you got to have a passion for that work if you want to be good at it, you know?
Exactly.
And Steve, you and I, over our careers, we worked together a lot, talked a lot. We share a lot of the same opinions about, you know, how the job ought to be done and how public service ought to be done and what it takes to be a good public servant. I always enjoy talking to you about it.
Same here.
You know, I got to back up though. I don't know why to this whole Army thing.
Yeah.
You told me once that when you were in the, I think, basic training, you were like in the next barracks over from another future Fish and Wildlife Special Agent named Dirk Hoy. And I think that's why I think you were in the airborne. I don't know why I had that in my head. Because Dirk was airborne, wasn't he?
He was. I know we had the same job, combat engineering.
Okay.
Yeah, it was amazing when Dirk ended up in Idaho when I was here in Wyoming.
And right.
He was helping me with a grizzly case, in fact. And we got to talking because I didn't get to spend a lot of time with him. But on that case, we did. And it was unbelievable how parallel our lives had been to get to where we were at. And we got to talking about being in the military and the same job description and the time frame. And I was like an Alpha Company and he was, I think, in Bravo Company, which they do. Alpha Company started, let's say, on January 1st. Bravo Company started on January 7th. So we were like a week apart. And it was phenomenal that we were marching up and down the same, you know, roads and same courses, everything, a week behind each other.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's amazing. So.
It's such a weird small world sometimes, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm getting to the bottom of it because I think I always assumed Dirk was airborne because he was injured on a parachuting in France.
Okay.
So that's how I don't know why. Maybe I always, that's how the whole thing started. Anyway, so speaking of grizzly bears, you brought up grizzly bears. One of the last places, you know, as a special agent for Fish and Wildlife Service, you had a really interesting career. You worked in some difficult places. You worked in some fun places. You were assigned to Colorado for a while, Wisconsin as an agent. But you spent a lot of time up in Alaska working as what we called you were an agent, but you're also an agent pilot, which means you were certified to fly planes for the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is, you know, invaluable up there in Alaska. I got to hand it to you. We're not going to talk about Alaska today, but I was, as an agent, one of the places I never wanted to go was Alaska because it's the laws up there regarding Native Alaskans are so complicated. Mm-hmm. I never wanted to do it. I always admired any agent that was willing to go up there to Alaska and deal with the issues you guys dealt with. It's pretty incredible. Your last duty station though was in Lander, Wyoming, isn't that right?
That's right.
Yeah. And that is right in the heart of grizzly bear country. So today we're going to talk about grizzly bear cases, which can be a little bit controversial. I want you to fill in the gaps for me here. I'm going to give a very rough background to grizzly bears in the U.S. and you fill in the gaps for me. But basically, just so our listeners know, the grizzly bear is a bear native to the United States. It was pretty much found throughout the Western United States up until the 1900, early, you know, turn of the century in 1900. Even California had grizzly bears as far down as the Los Angeles area early, you know, in the 1800s. But by, you know, early 1900s, the grizzly bear was almost what they call extirpated from the lower 48 states. Of course, there are grizzly bears in Alaska. And so basically almost extinct or removed from the lower 48 states. There was only a few pockets of grizzly bear, wild grizzly bear populations left, the greater Yellowstone area there, and maybe a few in northern Idaho and Montana. So they were listed as threatened under the U.S. Endangered Species Act, and then a whole federal recovery program started, and they got federal protection. At this point, grizzly bears, as of about 2017, I think, have met the recovery thresholds under the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service guidelines. But given what has happened with wolves, now that wolves have been delisted and states, some of the states have taken over management and have basically just allowed massive killings of wolves, wanting to take them down to the bear minimum numbers to keep them from being relisted by the Fish and Wildlife Service. I think there's a reluctance to delist the grizzly bear because they're afraid the states are going to allow massive hunting of grizzly bears. So for now, even though they've met recovery threshold numbers, they're still listed under the Endangered Species Act as threatened and given federal protection. Does that about sum it up, Steve, or did I miss anything? You're much more of a grizzly expert than I am.
No, that's a good summary based on the Fish and Wildlife Service's management of grizzly bears. And I would add this to it, that roughly, if people are wondering, well, how many bears do we have in the lower 48? It's right. Just under 2,000. And and they're in, you know, the upper western states, Idaho, Montana, parts of Washington, and Wyoming. So that's it. And interestingly, you know, when bears got captured here, like nuisance bears that got into trouble in town or on livestock, they're always looking for places to take them because bears are pretty territorial. And I always thought we should be shipping a few to California, seeing you guys had it on your flag down there. You guys might want a few representatives of the species in your state again. I don't know if that would have gone over very well. So,
yeah, you know, I'd be all for it. And believe it or not, you know, people think of California as a fairly congested place, but there are parts of northern and northeastern California that are extremely remote and very rugged. In fact, I think there are 4 wolf packs now that have naturally migrated into the state. And Northern California is perfect habitat for supporting big predators without too much human conflict. So, you know, I don't know, might not be impossible. There's even wolverines show up in California every once in a while. There's more to this grizzly bear thing, and we'll talk about it more as we go on. It can be controversial because, of course, grizzly bears are apex predators, and that greater Yellowstone area has become more and more populated over the years. As grizzly bear numbers have recovered, human numbers have increased in that area. There's a lot of, you know, homes going up in the, you know, Jackson Hole area south of Yellowstone National Park. There's homes in east of the park going up. And as that happens, more and more people are having conflict with these apex predators, which sometimes will prey on domestic animals, particularly agricultural animals like calves from cattle and calves, sheep and lambs, llamas, that type of thing. And there's always this conflict between particularly cattle ranch or ranchers in general and apex predators in these remote areas. So there's a lot of nuances to this. Steve and I are going to talk about them today, but let's start off. We'll get into those issues as we talk, Steve, because I did do some research on some numbers that I think will be helpful. But let's talk specifically about a particular grizzly bear case you handled called the Barber Point grizzly case. You remember that case, right?
I do.
Was that one of the last cases you handled as an agent before you retired?
Let me put it this way. It was the first case I handled when I transferred to Wyoming.
Oh, even better.
Yeah, it was just ongoing for 4 years to finally get to closure.
As many of our cases do, they can take a while.
Yeah, there's reasons for that, but most of it was because of the defendants involved. It was just, they made it, it was a challenge. So,
Yeah, and so what a crazy way to get indoctrinated into working in Wyoming, right? You've got this grizzly bear case. And when we tell you, say grizzly bear case, basically, because they're listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, they fall within the jurisdiction of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's prohibited to kill them or take them, as the law defines it. And so anytime that happens, even if it's in self-defense, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agent will generally investigate to determine whether or not the self-defense was justified or whether or not it was an intentional take of a protected species, which would be a crime under the Endangered Species Act. So you got right in, you dropped your feet right into the fire on the Barber Point grizzly bear case. But let's talk about, so tell us about what happened. What was the situation with this bear up at the Barber Point area?
Okay. First of all, I can't understate the importance that it is to work with state agencies that have to manage grizzly bears as well. The Wyoming Game and Fish Department, in particular, an officer there named Brian DeBolt, he was just a fabulous resource for me to work with here when I got here. And I think the world of Brian, and I think the public does too. And he has a tough job managing grizzlies in a western state with a lot of agriculture. And then the field wardens, Brian was what they call a large carnivore wildlife game warden. So he had called me and he said that they had received a complaint from a married couple who had found a dead grizzly bear off of the Barber Point Road up in Dubois, still part of Fremont County where Lander's located. This bear was dead about 120 yards off the road, and that's kind of all we knew. And so Brian and I planned to meet the complainants up there, and they could show us. Now, for those who haven't been in this part of the world, there's a mountain range between here and the Grand Tetons called the Wind River Mountain Range. And there's a pass that crosses over to there called Togedy Pass. And where this bear was killed is probably a couple miles from this pass that drops down into the Teton Valley. So this is about 9,000 feet that we're talking. It's in the fall. And this road, this Barber's Point Road, it's not the kind of road that you can do 70 on. It's a two-track road that you go about 5 or 10 miles an hour on, because it's just a two-track road going through the National Forest.
Okay.
Where this road goes, this Barber's Point Road, it's pretty narrow and wooded, and then some open meadows and stuff. So it's a two-track road in the middle of the National Forest. So
okay.
So we had met this married couple up there who had seen it, and they took us to it. And interesting about this, the reason they saw the bear, it was on what we call a cache. And a cache is a situation where there's some kind of dead animal, and the bears like to hoard it. So they try to hide it by covering it up with dirt, leaves, and debris. And this bear was dead right on top of this cache. Mm-hmm. And you could see it down from this Barber's Point Road. And the reason they had went there is because people in the nearby town called Dubois had been talking about this bear on this elk carcass that was there. And people were going up to drive the road just to see the bear. So this couple went up there to go see the bear, and when they got there, it was laying dead on top of the cache.
You know, this is interesting, because I think a lot of times, sometimes we think that the people in Wyoming are anti-grizzly bear. They don't like them, but there are a lot of people in Wyoming who enjoy seeing grizzly bears in the wild, right? I mean, that this bear, even though it was a wild bear, it was sitting on this cache of dead elk, and like you said, people were actively going up there just to watch it, right? They wanted to be wildlife watchers and see this cool bear doing its thing, right?
Exactly.
So this couple goes up there to see this bear, and they find out it's dead.
Yeah.
So you get called because it's a potential crime. You don't know why the bear's dead, but what'd you find when you got up there?
So when we responded, and when I say we, it took a village to get this part done. Let me explain this. When you go into a grizzly kill site, even if there's a dead bear there, worse if the bear is wounded. You got to go track this thing down. It's not a job you want to do yourself. And you describe them as an apex predator, and they don't know that they're sharing the food chain top with us. They think they're at the top. And it's pretty ominous going through a willow stand looking for an injured grizzly. And it's even ominous going into a site where there's a dead bear. And the reason being, bears will eat anything, especially in the fall. They have that hyperphagia period where they just go on a feeding frenzy. So we didn't go alone. It wasn't just me or Brian DeBolt. We brought the local warden, Brian Baker, and then a couple Forest Service guys, one in particular, Dirk Schalfant. He was a ranger for the Forest Service. So there's four or five of us that went in to go into this grizzly kill site. And the reason is we figured we'd have to do a field necropsy, which is an autopsy for animals. Right. And we had to go in there and do this. And while some people are working on it with their heads down, paying attention to what they're doing, you needed other people to stand guard in case another bear came in and decided to feed on the cached elk in this case, or even scavenge the grizzly bear, which it would do, which they do.
Exactly.
So we went to do this crime scene to see if there was a crime committed. And we didn't know.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but this is just so people understand. This is basically like a murder investigation. The bear is dead. You don't know why yet, but it could be a crime occurred. So the techniques you're using are really very similar to what a homicide detective would do. You've got to do a full crime scene and figure out what happened. The only difference is, of course, because a bear is so big, you're going to do the necropsy, which is an animal autopsy, like you said, out in the field rather than taking it somewhere, which is would be a big effort. And I do want to add too, when I worked in Africa, I was on a couple of crime scenes involving rhinos and elephants. And the same thing is true there. When you go out, you maybe have 2-3 officers doing the crime scene investigation. And then you have probably 5 or 6 with you who have shotguns or rifles who are basically protecting you from the predators who are out there. Like, you know, in Africa, you might be doing a crime scene, like you said, with your head down. There could be lions coming in to feed on this crime scene that you're trying to process. And that's true in Wyoming, Montana as well. You might have another grizzly bear coming in or a black bear to feed on this elk or this dead bear, and you can't be hovered over it with your head down, or you could become the next victim.
Yeah, that's what we have in common with our comrades over in Africa, you know, kindred souls standing guard over with other predators lurking.
Exactly. So you're up there, you're going to do a crime scene on this stinky dead bear. What happened? What'd you find out?
So we did in fact find the bear was on top of a cache, and it was laying on top when the complainants found it. And when animals die, they bloat and the stomach starts to get big. So the bear actually rolled off the cache on its side, and its legs are sticking up in the air. And what we had found once we did the necropsy, that we did find a bullet hole, and the bullet had entered in through the right side. Refresh my memory here. The bullet had entered in from the behind the bear on the left side. It traveled through the bear's body, and it stopped on the right side, like on the outside the shoulder, but stuck against the skin. So it didn't go all the way through. And we were able to get the bullet with the aid of a metal detector. We knew it had a bullet in it. So then we dissected it, got the bullet out, and we could tell that it was a 30 caliber bullet. And then we could see the bullet path going through it. So for the purposes of a crime, we knew that we had a dead bear. And now that it was shot, It meets the first step. It violates the Endangered Species Act. It's a grizzly bear that's protected, but there's some exceptions to killing a grizzly bear. And in defense of oneself, a bear can be killed. But my experience doing these, you know, defense of life cases, whether it's a bear, a wolf, not that we had any of those, or a mountain lion when I was a state guy that people were afraid of, most of these animals are shot head on. They're not shot from behind like this bear was, and then shot from behind and then traveled through the to the front of the bear's body and stop on the shoulder. So we had a bullet. So now we have a crime scene for sure. We know that this right. bear was killed, and it wasn't killed in defense of anybody's life at this point, if it was shot from behind. So
right.
Didn't add up. So we treated the woods like a crime scene. We spread out, and we found some footprints. We found some tire tracks. We ended up finding some shell casings for the bear in the area, some ATV tracks going down the hill from Barber Point Road down to the kill site. And, you know, that's all we've got. And we collected that evidence just to see if it would be related later. So, and we had, you know, I got to say this. In all the years I've done this from the very first year, and you come to a crime scene like that, and, you know, no grizzlies are going to come out and say, hey, somebody just shot my cousin here or my mom or anything. You don't have family members to go interview. So I've always thought this, and I don't, maybe I'm weird, but I always like thought to myself in my head, I wish I was a time traveler so I could just see what happened here, you know,
yeah.
or that's not possible. So I think in my head, I hope the game warden gods give us a few breaks in this case so we can figure out what happened. And, you know, you hope that somehow you can put this together to figure out why this bear was killed.
Yeah, you know, that is exactly right. I mean, when a crime like this happens out in the wilderness, there are no animals can't call you. There's no witness among the animal world who's going to call you and give you a tip, right? It's yeah. These are tough cases to solve, and you do have to hope that the adage is true that God loves game wardens. So you have to hope that something comes up, because you walk away with pretty good evidence, but you know, in the end, Steve, you got some bullet casings, you got some tire tracks. You got a bullet fragment out of the bear, you know what direction the bear was shot from, but all of that footprints, none of that is valuable unless you have something to compare it to. If you've got tire tracks, you got to find a car to compare it to. If you have footprints, you got to find a shoe. If you have a bullet casing or a bullet, you got to find a gun. And right. so now, yeah, you walk away from your crime scene, you got pretty good stuff, but now what? What do you do next, you know?
And it's hunting season, it's the fall, it's beautiful in the mountains. Fortunately, the Forest Service agent that was with us, Dirk Chalfant, very good public relations guy in his community, and he had heard that who killed the elk that the bears were feeding on there, and they took the usable portions of the elk and left part of the carcass there, the skin, the hide, and the rib cage. And the bears were feeding on that. So we knew who that was. So we tracked this guy down, thinking it's not uncommon for people to hunt over a former kill site for coyotes or some other predator. And we thought, oh, this is a good tip. Let's go talk to this guy. So okay. we tracked this guy down. He was very helpful. After the interview, didn't suspect that he was involved. He had an affinity for bears. He had seen bears on that elk carcass. Watched them, took pictures. He said there were a couple different bears coming in and out of that feed site. And then one day it was cached, and he hadn't seen the dead bear yet. So that was a good tip. And then we go back to praying to the game warden gods. You know, we don't have any suspects. Right. But to moving this along, the game warden gods did give us a break. So Brian Baker, the game warden in Du Bois, calls up and says, hey, I just got a call from a guy. He was in a bar here in Du Bois, and this guy named Kelly Grove was in the bar whooping it up and talking about this bear up there at Barber's Point, and started bragging about shooting it.
And perfect.
He's telling this story, and Kelly Grove is a colorful character, to say the least. Every other word is the F-bomb, and he's right. telling the story, and he hates grizzly bears, and he may let it know. Let it be known in the bar that he had no affinity for the bears. And he talked about coming up on this bear, told a very detailed story about how he came up on it while he was elk hunting. The bear charged him and bluff charged him. And he fired four shots with a 300 Win Mag and killed the bear. But he also said prior to that, he had actually seen the bear on another day, and him and a friend went up there, and he was bragging about how they taunted the bear from Barber's Point Road to get some cool footage of it, like bluff charging. They're throwing right. rocks at the bear. And in that same general area is where we found these 10 millimeter shell casings. So we thought maybe he was, you know, And when he was bragging in the bar, he was talking about he had a 10 millimeter with him in case he couldn't kill the bear with a rifle.
Okay.
His friends are like, Kelly, man, you shouldn't be telling this story in the bar. There's lots of people around. And the person who had called, the game warden, God love this guy. He turned on his recorder and recorded
on his phone.
On his phone and recorded the whole conversation.
Nice.
So we had a recorded, basically a confession, a bar confession from Kelly Grove saying he shot the bear on Barber's Point Road.
Interesting. But he was claiming to the, he was bragging to the bar that he was hinting that he shot it in self-defense, sounds like, though, huh?
Yeah, he threw that in there, wove that story in. Yeah, but he also wove in how he taunted this bear, and he knew the bear was in the area. And, of course, he spewed a lot of hate about grizzlies and thought the best bear was a dead bear and kill them all. And
now, what, you know, explain that a little bit. So let's get into the controversy a little. Why do people there is a group of people in Wyoming, Montana, and the western states where grizzlies occur. There are a lot of people who like to go watch them, take photos of them, see them in the wild. But there are these people that like have this weird, intense hatred of grizzlies. Why is that? Why do people hate grizzlies up there that do?
You know, having done this for 30 years, and you could probably say the same thing. You could take any wildlife species on the planet and you will find an audience out there who absolutely love these things to death. And then people who think they should be eliminated from the landscape. And wildlife takes it on the chin. Whether it's a black-tailed chickadee pecking on someone's log house, trying to get ant eggs out of it and setting rat traps on the side of it to kill them, or, you know, elephants for their ivory, you know, loving things to death. The spectrum is broad. Grizzlies are unique in that, I mean, their scientific name is Ursus horribilis. You know, people, you know, that horribilis comes from someone who knew something about having to deal with a pretty bad bear. And that was scary. So I think that it's interesting to me that people who live in Du Bois, at least through this investigation, it was hard to find anybody in and around this Kelly Grove circle of friends and family that didn't hate grizzly bears. And I'm like, you live in one of the most beautiful areas in Wyoming. It's a Serengeti of wildlife up there, but very low to no tolerance for grizzly bears. And I know the majority of the country, the other 47 or six states that don't have grizzly bears, people travel to this place to vacation, and the chance to see a grizzly bear is a chance of a lifetime.
Yeah, so, and they spend a lot of money in those communities when they come up there to look for grizzlies to photograph and to see.
And you spelled it out pretty well about at least the agriculture interests that take it on the chin. But at the same time, you know, there's compensation involved in reimbursing ranchers that lose livestock. One group you left out in your description is there are some hunters out there who absolutely believe that grizzlies and wolves were the demise of good hunting opportunities and big game populations for themselves. So some of those guys out there don't appreciate it. And that part of the hunting community is hard to understand for me personally, because these animals were recovered because of sportsmen's dollars buying conservation programs. And they should be waving that success as hunters, as a banner of success that we brought these animals back from the brink of extinction.
Yeah. 100%.
And instead, they just want to hate them because they didn't get their elk that year. I mean, I've heard, having done these investigations regarding grizzlies and wolves throughout my career, you know, I've heard a lot of that anti-apex predator sentiment. And, you know, we got 360 million people in our country, but we got less than 2,000 bears, and some of these people don't think we should even have those. That's hard for me to wrap my head around as a conservationist.
Me too. And if you see, you know, that this argument, for whatever reason, when this comes up, in my experience, the anti-predator people, the people who hate wolves, hate grizzly bears, they completely dismiss any discussion about the benefits of having these apex predators in the environment. And when I say benefits, I mean benefits for healthy elk and deer populations. They almost refuse to see the science that it's well proven that the existence of apex predators actually improves the health of elk and deer herds. But they just refuse to see that. I'm sure you've experienced that too, where that you can tell them that all day long, that deer and elk populations are better off now than they were when there were no wolves and no grizzly bears around, and they just won't listen.
No, and then one of the other things that's tough too is this, in this case, this bear was killed on public land owned right. by the people of the United States. The people, not the government, the people right. own this land. And as part of that multiple use mandate for the Forest Service, it includes, you know, releasing cattle and sheep into the forest to graze.
Yep.
And, but that often comes at the expense of people's wildlife too.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes the agricultural community, it seems to me that the deck is stacked in their favor, that we've got a whole nother branch of the government that goes out and removes predators from the landscape just to protect these domesticated animals that are turned loose in the wilderness
yeah.
and roaming around on the forest. And that,
yeah.
that's a rub between the agriculture interests, the recreational interests, and the, you know, the people who want to just see a bear for the first time in their lives.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that's where the controversy gets really heated, because the value that, or lack of value that people have for a species is what makes it controversial. But
yep.
just like the bears and the landscape, those all belong to us, the American people, as a whole.
Yeah.
And, I had a professor in college call, you know, if you're going to dump, on the bears and the wolves because you don't like them, you know, and because they're killing your livestock, you got to be willing to pay a little ecological rent for using the landscape. And I always liked that concept.
Yeah, exactly. That's rent. It's rent. Yeah, exactly. It's part of the cost of being able to graze your sheep or cattle on public land. And it's part of the cost of having the public land available to all of us. That's great. You know, I want to get back to the Barber Point case, but I do want to offer some statistics here that are just a little bit different than the argument of it's good for the deer and the elk population. And I'm going to put some of this, or at least I'll put links to it on the NatureSecretService.com website so people can go look themselves. But what always shocks me so much is the people that are anti-predator, anti-bear, they just will not do the most minimal amount of research to verify their assumptions or what they've heard at the local bar or what they've heard at the local hunting club or whatever about the impact of grizzly bears on either domestic cattle or livestock or deer and elk populations. So if you'll indulge me, I know you'll appreciate this. The first thing is, let's just take Wyoming as an example, since that's where you were working and that's where this case was. If you can go to the Wyoming, is it Game and Fish? What's the Wyoming?
Yes,
is Wyoming Game and Fish. If you go to the Wyoming Game and Fish website, you can download the number of available elk and deer hunting permits going back 40 years. I mean, it's publicly available. A lot of it's on their website. If it's not on there, you can just ask them and they'll send it to you. And you can see how many permits have been issued to hunters to kill deer and elk in that state. And you can also compare it to, well, what was the success rate? Of all the permits that were issued, how many hunters actually killed a deer or an elk? And if you look at those numbers going back 40 years, they've almost changed, not at all. They fluctuate a little bit year to year, just based on, because, you know, the state sets its hunting license numbers or quotas based on deer and elk populations. But so they fluctuate a little bit every year. But on the whole, over the last 40 years, the number of deer and elk tags has not changed significantly, and the number of killed deer and elk by hunters has not changed significantly. There's just looking at those numbers alone, there's absolutely no evidence to support any conclusion that grizzly bears or wolves or any other predator are hurting hunting opportunities in Wyoming. There's just no evidence to that, looking at the state's own numbers. And then if we want to look at livestock, and I looked at USDA records before I came here to record this today, and USDA is the agency you were talking about. It's a federal agency, but it spends a lot of time and effort helping to remove predators from the West, right? It's not exactly a wildlife friendly agency. It's much more friendly to agriculture. But they have on their website, they have records going back 40 years. And if you look, I'm just going to read some of the numbers and then we'll get back to the Barber Point case. If we're just talking about sheep and lamb losses in Wyoming, only in Wyoming, in 1985, 40 years ago, they lost 36,000 sheep and lambs to all known causes, to all causes. Only 0.8% of those losses could be attributed to bears. And it's not grizzly bears, it's all bears, including black bears. 0.8%. If we jump ahead 10 years, 1995, it was 1.2%. In 2005, it was 2.5%. In 2015, it was 0.9%, so it dropped back down below 1%. And then in 2024, it was 3% of all lost sheep and lamb could be attributed to all bears, not just grizzly bears, but all bears. Those numbers, yeah, they've gone up a little bit, but they're shockingly minimal compared to all the other causes that kill, you know, livestock in the state of Wyoming. And so to be, it just strikes me as odd to be so kind of aggressively focused on predators as the cause of all problems when respiratory illness kills more livestock in Wyoming than any predator ever does. It's not grizzly bears that are causing significant losses to ranchers or hunters. It's just not. And there's no way you can argue otherwise. You just look at the data from state and federal agencies. It does not support a conclusion that these are having a significant impact on hunting recreation or domestic agriculture. Yeah, I mean, anyway, I didn't mean to get off on a side, but I know that some of our listeners are going to be like, they're going to hear what we have to say about this Barber Point grizzly, and they're going to say, yeah, but before they say that in the comments on the website page, on the podcast page, you know, I just ask you, please go look at your own state's data before you go down that road of start saying, yeah, but, because, you know, the data just doesn't support those conclusions. Anyway, so back to our friend Kelly Grove now, who's made this crazy admission in a bar. What do you do with this? So this person who made the recording, I assume they come forward, they talk to either the Wyoming Game and Fish warden or you. What do you do with that information?
So when he did talk to the local warden there, and he made contact with them, got a copy of the recording, which we've got, and then I listened to it intently to transcribe it. So obviously we want to talk to Kelly Grove about this now that he's bragged right about it. But so we started doing some background checks on Kelly Grove, and he's got an extensive criminal history. To not exclude all of his past wildlife violations, he's a repeat frequent flyer, we call him. And he had been caught by the state of Wyoming participating in an illegal bighorn sheep hunt and ended up taking a revocation for that. And he had multiple other violations, not to include some other non-wildlife related convictions. So he'd been through the system and figured he'd be a tougher interview. But I think, you know, social media was handy at this time too. We did a check on his Facebook page, and he posted some things about bears and other things he had killed. Interestingly, for the state, he had posted a picture where he shot an antelope 2 days before the antelope season archery hunt started, and he was posing with this antelope with a rifle.
With a rifle.
So that math seemed a little odd. So based on the statements for, and I should say under Wyoming code, they have bears listed as a protected species as well. So the state drafted up a search warrant for the state trust species of antelope and included in that things related to the grizzly bear that we knew about so far.
Okay.
You know, Kelly Grove said he had a 30 caliber rifle he shot the bear with. You know, he bragged about it in the bar. 10 millimeter. We had telemeter cases. You know, we needed more evidence, and we met the probable cause to get a search warrant. So nice. We went to interview Kelly.
And now this is a search warrant of his house specifically look for those firearms, right?
Yeah, and any other evidence related to the bear or the antelope. So
So
I and the state investigator, Scott Browning, he's my counterpart, if you will, an investigator for the state. And he and I went to do the interview, and then we had other officers on hand to do the search. As expected, Kelly denied and lied about everything we asked him about. And he made it clear, and it was kind of a chance for him to grandstand about his hatred towards bears. He denied even being in the area of Barber's Point in the early part of the interview. He started to recant that and admitted he saw the bear at Barber's Point three different times. He admitted throwing rocks at it. He took pictures and videos of it. He still denied shooting it now, in contrast or in contradiction to the recording that he was captured on in the bar. He denied even talking to anybody about a grizzly bear. But when I asked him if, you know, the investigation showed that he killed this bear, would he pay restitution for it? And Kelly said, yeah, I would. Who pays restitution okay. for a bear they didn't shoot, I guess. And in the middle of this interview, I should mention that when we went to do the warrant, he wasn't home. So we called him before we went in the house. You know, we wanted to have him there on hand when we did this. So we called him, and he showed up, and he had some friends with him. They'd been out cruising around in the forest, and some of his friends came. And in the middle, they stayed outside while we did our job. And then in the middle of that interview, one of his friends, Matt Brooks, came into the house and interrupted the interview. And we wondered why he was allowed in the house or how he got in so quickly.
Yeah, exactly. You're supposed to have outside security there.
Yeah. Shortly after he left, we found a recording device running on the kitchen counter. He was recording our interview with Kelly for his own benefit, which is...
No kidding.
We got a word for that. Suspicious.
Yeah. He came into the house ostensibly to use the bathroom. And then while he was there, he kind of surreptitiously left a recording device on the counter to eavesdrop on what you were saying. Is that it?
Yeah, exactly.
Crazy.
Yeah. So anyhow, Kelly made comments like, I didn't pull any triggers on any bears. And I asked him if he was involved or knew who he was. He said, no, but if I did, I'd shake that person's hand for killing the grizzly bear.
Oh, nice.
And just belligerent about that part of it. So in the search warrant, we ended up getting Kelly's phone, got the rifle, the ammo, and then some 10mm ammo. We could not find his pistol, and that'll become a little bit later.
And so, that's, you had mentioned 10mm early, but you didn't mention that 10mm was a pistol ammo, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So you couldn't find the 10mm pistol, but you did find a rifle that the same caliber that would have been the bullet you found in the bear, right?
Yeah. It was consistent with at least the caliber of the bear.
Yeah.
Now, whether it was that rifle or not, we didn't know without lab testing.
Okay.
And we made arrangements to have this evidence processed through our lab at the National.
Okay.
So next step is, next on our list to talk to is Matt Brooks. We want to know why he's recording this phone call or this interview.
Exactly.
So, we go talk to him. He admits placing the recorder. He said he just wants to know what we were talking about because he thought it had something to do with a bunch of antelope that he might have been involved with. So he was scared. And he admitted it was related to that. He denied any knowledge about Grove shooting a grizzly bear. And when we asked him, if he wanted to help cooperate in this investigation, tell us why, he was there with a recorder. He said, no, I don't want to be involved or help you anymore. And then it comes down to the evidence. What did we find as a result of the search warrant? The cell phone was a treasure trove of information. And we found a bunch of stuff related to bears, numerous photos and videos of the bears at Barber's Point. We were able to firm up that Kelly had killed an antelope illegally with a rifle in a close season. We also found pictures of him setting illegal bear baits for black bear. So they were black bear hunting as well. Nobody got the edge for that, though, or a permit, bear baiting permit. So there were other state violations. There were videos of grizzly bears. We also saw Matt Brooks and Kelly Grove illegally hunting and shooting from a highway at other animals. They were shooting at migratory birds while they were hunting over baited sites. I know this is going to seem petty, but this lends to the psychology of Kelly Grove. He worked on an oil field, and this offended our U.S. attorney more than anything. He's running around this oil field drill site with a tool trying to kill a rabbit. With a tool, like a wrench. He had some mice in his dwelling there, I guess the trailer he was staying in. So he was capturing these mice and then him and another guy were playing baseball with the mice. Like,
oh my gosh.
Calling it a home run. And, you know, it was, they're mice. I get it. They're rodents. People kill them. But in the manner and the enjoyment that he was having, one of the head U.S. attorney here in Lander, she found that deeply disturbing about this guy's mindset, that he'd kill anything and had no regard for anything living, which wasn't far from the truth. So a Facebook warrant we got for that and similar further evidence just to secure some of the things he was posting online.
Right, right. Yeah, there's something about, you know, there's one thing, killing an animal is one thing for food or hunting purposes, but taking, you know, a lot of joy out of it, kind of another thing. It's kind of just weird, right?
Yeah. So it lent itself to like the psychology of killing things. So
Yeah.
And then the lab results started coming in, and we found that the bullet was so smashed that we couldn't get the like fine characteristics from it. But we could tell that it had what we call six lands and grooves. And what that means is in a rifle barrel, it's got rifling is what they call on it. And it's a spiral shape going down the barrel, kind of like when you throw a football through the air, you want to spiral it. A bullet does the same thing. If you can get it to spin in the barrel, it's more accurate. And the way they do that is they etch these lands and grooves in there that make spiraling in there. And that leaves an impression on the bullet, just like a fingerprint does on a glass. Mm-hmm. So these lands and grooves told us that there were six lands and six grooves. So there's six cuts and then six raised areas that went around the bullet. And coincidentally, so did Kelly Grove's gun. And I had the same rifling. So that was a class characteristic, they call it, not a specific.
Yeah. Perfect. So, yeah, that's so the people that watch too much CSI TV shows, that what you have is essentially circumstantial evidence. It's consistent. The bullet that you found in the bear was consistent with the gun that Kelly Groves owned, but not definitive, and that's because the bullet was so smashed up and damaged, right?
Right. Correct.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, thanks. That's a good clarification.
Yeah, so. And also, just so listeners know, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has its own forensic crime lab, and they're the ones that did this analysis for you. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. Okay. All right. So good. You got some circumstantial evidence here. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. We kind of got a miss on the 10 millimeter casings for one particular reason. We didn't have the pistol and we couldn't do any matching with that. And Kelly said that he had it and he would turn it over to us. He just didn't know where it was at the time of the search. And no surprise, he said he lost it. And of course it was never reported stolen either. But in the course of going through his phone, we found a bunch of texts and other things that people he had communicated with. So we had a whole laundry list of people we wanted to talk to in and around the Dubois. Dubois is a small Western town. So it was a small town. So we knew we had to talk to people in town who might know about this. So we assembled a group of people, of agents. And in fact, Dirk Coy, who we talked about earlier, came over and he came and helped with this. And anyhow, we rounded up anybody that was mentioned in and around this grizzly killing in text or phone calls and things like that. And tried to, you know, glean out more information related to Grove killing this bear. I re-interviewed Matt Brooks with another officer, and we found out that Kelly Grove got booted out of his house after the search warrant, and he moved in with Matt Brooks. So they started living together. Asked him if they talked about it. He says, no, we haven't even talked about the grizzly thing. And I'm like, yeah, sure. So, but he said he knows Kelly didn't shoot the bear. We confronted him with the evidence of other crimes on Kelly's phone that Matt Brooks was involved in. And to his credit, he took responsibility for illegally hunting black bears without a license over illegal baits. He said that he drank too much and they were driving around shooting out of the vehicle. He shot his antelope from a truck. He shot at a white-tailed deer, all kinds of other state-related wildlife charges. And we asked him about Kelly Grove hiding the gun. He said, you know, Kelly backtracked. He thought maybe it fell out of the truck somewhere. So we went into the mountains to go look where he might have dropped this gun. And he brought a bunch of us with. And Kelly knew that, you know, you guys were going to be talking to other people in town. So he brought whoever would come with to help him find his pistol. And Brooks, his, you know, has his roommate says, yeah, I was pretty ticked off about that. You know, he drove us around. And then like at the end of it, he made a comment that, you know, we're not going to find it. He says, but I know ahead of time, those officers are never going to get their hands on that gun anyways, which Brooks said he interpreted that it was hiding somewhere that only Grove knew about and we weren't going to get our hands on it. And at that time, Brooks had claimed to be a bad liar. That'll be relevant later. So this was pretty interesting. There's Kelly's friend that the couple that called us about this bear.
Uh-huh.
This one, the husband, he actually was in the bar when Kelly was bragging about killing this bear.
No kidding.
And it struck me as very odd that him and his wife would call us about a dead bear. And then after we had gone and got the bear, he had heard Kelly Grove bragging about killing this bear in the bar. And he never called us.
Yeah.
And nor did his wife. And she knew about it as well. So we wanted to re-interview them to find out, you knew we were investigating this bear. Why didn't you call us? Well, we were good friends with Kelly Grove. And they actually knew about the bears being up there on this cache because Kelly Grove told them about it.
Oh.
So they went up there to go see the bear. And this is what they said. When we got there and saw the dead bear, both of them simultaneously thought to themselves, Kelly killed this bear.
Oh, my gosh.
Only to find out later he was bragging in a bar that he did. So that was his reputation in that town that he had actually killed this bear. So
unbelievable.
Yeah. And he... You know, talking to this couple, they, you know, said the reason they didn't want to come forward is it's a small town and they didn't want to, they were worried about repercussions and they didn't want to be a rat and Kelly's a friend. And, you know, they were just worried about the upshot of, you know, being the ones who called in the first place. And now suddenly the friend's the main suspect. So anyhow, so go ahead.
Yeah. Wasn't there like a deal with some gun being buried in this case?
Yeah. Coming up on that.
So, oh, sorry.
Yeah. So I got to tell you this part because this is, we interviewed a few other people. So we had enough at this point to go to the grand jury.
Okay. And
for your listeners who don't know what that is, it's just a place where we go with the U.S. attorney and there's jurors there. They hear the government's case and decide if they have enough to take the case forward or to get, you know, subpoenas issued to get more evidence. But they decided after our testimony that Kelly Grove, you know, there's enough evidence to, you know, charge Kelly Grove with killing this grizzly bear. So he was indicted in the grand jury. And
okay, for violating the Endangered Species Act, yeah?
That's correct. Okay. So this is like in November of 2017, like 2 years after the bear was killed.
We finally finished.
I'm not going to go over every interview we did and waiting. You know, it took time for all this stuff to come to fruition. But we indicted him in November. He pled not guilty, and his trial was set for February. So probably about a week before we went to trial, Brian Baker, the game warden from Du Bois, gets a phone call. And it's a woman who is a scorned girlfriend of Matt Brooks.
Oh, boy.
And so she says that you guys are investigating the wrong guy. Kelly Grove didn't shoot the bear. My ex-boyfriend did, Matt Brooks.
Oh, boy.
So we're like, oh, great. We're ready to go to trial on Kelly. So we have to determine the, you know, we got such a runaround from so many people involved in this case who did not want to provide information or cooperate in the small town. And we thought maybe this was a ruse to, like, throw a wrench into the case. So I traveled up to Montana with another agent who's assigned there, Mona Iannelli, and she and I interviewed this woman face-to-face. And her description of what happened, there's no way she could have known any of this unless someone told her. The details were staggering about what had happened once this investigation launched. To illustrate, she said that she told us that when I interviewed Matt Brooks a second time, he and her were living together in a town called Casper. And he was at work when we interviewed him, Brian Baker and I. And he was pretty rattled. And he had gone home after the interview, went into the bathroom, she said, had her leave her phone and his phone on the counter because he felt like Big Brother was using the phones to listen to what was going on. And I know you and I laugh like that's the things people think, and that was, you know, we don't have that, right. Didn't have that capability. But he was so paranoid that we were eavesdropping on this, and he went in the bathroom, turned on the fan, and told her that he had done some really stupid things before they started dating, to include shooting this grizzly bear. And he described that Kelly Grove was with him, how they did it. And she says, well, what are you going to do? He says, well, they're never going to make this case stick because they don't have the right gun. And she's like, well, why not? He goes, well, I shot it, used my gun, and it's buried up in the mountains by Dubois there. He goes, I put it in an oily rag, wrapped it in plastic, and I buried it. He actually buried it with Kelly Grove and another guy, she said.
Unbelievable.
And he was so scared that they were going to rat him out and tell him where the gun's at, that he went there by himself, dug it up, and moved it to another place and buried it again. So this is like his prized rifle possession. So, I mean, things like this is just, you don't make that up. And and she said that he wasn't worried about the other wildlife crimes as much as he was about the grizzly bear. Now, this informant, the ex-girlfriend, she was really worried about coming forward because prior to their breakup, she was pregnant and miscarried. And the night before her miscarriage, her and Matt got in a big fight, and he headbutted her, split her head open, and she had to go to the ER on her own and got stitches. Shortly thereafter, of course, they broke up because of domestic violence. She went through a DNC to have the dead baby removed from, you know, that procedure, they call that. And she talked about a, you know, like she needed to get away from him at that point. He didn't even show up at the hospital. She went through this procedure. She went into detail about, I said, well, how do I know you're not making this up or just repeating what you heard? She says, we had our own code when it came to talking about this bear around other people. He called it his boomstick, which meant his rifle. And then he'd use the digging gesture with a shovel, you know, like that her and him would use this little code. And she said she was, I asked her why she was coming forward. And she said that she felt that, you know, at the time she was too afraid to stand up to him. And now that they've broken up, she had a, you know, support system around her. And she knew that Brooks's ex-wife had been beaten by him. He had told her that. And he was currently living with someone else. And she was just worried about him hurting someone else. Plus, he felt like he should be held accountable for killing this bear. So, so we go re-interview Brooks, and he lies, denies everything, says she's crazy. He did say Grove didn't shoot the bear or kill the bear. He said he talks to Grove all the time. And even though Grove had moved out of state for a job, but they still talked. And one of the interesting things that Brooks's girlfriend told us is that when Grove came back in for his trial that was scheduled, that he had came and stayed with Brooks in the house there overnight. And that's how she heard this whole story. So she knew that. So anyhow, he denied conspiring with Grove about the bear. And but I asked him about his gun, you know, because he didn't know that we knew about his gun.
Right.
I said, so I asked him where he buried it. And, you know, you could tell that shocked him, that his girlfriend didn't know for that. He didn't want us to get this gun. And we're leaning on him enough. You know, he conceded that he had taken it to a gunsmith and was having the barrel removed and having the gun changed to a completely different caliber.
Perfect to avoid that forensic evidence from the scene, right?
Exactly. So
unbelievable.
So he worked with the gunsmith who was helping him do this. So right after I left that interview, you know where I went? Right to the gunsmith. Yeah. Got my hands on all of that gun evidence from Brooks. And so needless to say, we canceled the trial for Kelly Grove because he didn't actually shoot it, which was, but he was involved, according to the ex-girlfriend. So,
So what happens? How'd you wrap this up? What were the final charges on everybody, and what was the outcome?
So we target letters went out, and obviously Grove and Brooks knew that the gig was up, so they entered into pleas. Grove ended up pleading guilty to harassing a grizzly bear, and the investigation showed that he did in fact shoot his 10 millimeter in the direction of the bear. So he's harassing a threatened species, which is carries the same penalty as shooting it.
Surprising. Yep.
He got a 5 years of unsupervised probation, a 5-year global hunting revocation through the Wildlife Violator Compact.
Right.
He was not fined, but he had to pay $7,000 in restitution.
Okay.
For all the wildlife damage, and he was sentenced in July. But as part of his plea, we wanted him to do a post-conviction interview so we could nail down all the facts of that particular case, plus use them against Brooks if necessary. So
right.
Brooks got a target letter, and same for him. He knew the gig was up. He ended up entering a plea agreement to plead guilty for shooting the bear, 5 years probation, 200 hours of community service, a 4-year worldwide hunting ban, $20,000 in restitution, no fine, forfeit the rifle, and he also did a post conviction proffer with us. So,
okay, so this is actually a pretty good penalty because, it's always shocking to people when you tell them that the Endangered Species Act, the maximum penalty under that is a Class A misdemeanor. And that's with regard to endangered species. If it's a threatened species, it's a Class B misdemeanor. So no matter what, even if it's a Class A misdemeanor, the maximum penalty is 1 year in jail and a $100,000 fine. So this penalty is actually pretty good. The other interesting thing that you mentioned is harassment, which is just causing, interfering with breeding, feeding, or sheltering of an endangered or threatened animal is the same as killing it. It's the same. It's considered take. And you can't harass them. And so throwing rocks at them or shooting bullets at them to scare them off of a kill site would be harassing them, interfering with feeding, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So that's not a bad penalty, especially the hunting guys like this who love to hunt, take away their hunting privileges for a few years. That hurts.
And I know you were short on time, but that wasn't the end of it.
Oh, no. Tell us more. We have five more minutes.
Yeah, this should take long. So Grove gets sentenced and the judge kind of basically tells him no screwing off while you're on probation. And this is in September. Well, that didn't last long. November 12th, we get another complaint, an anonymous complaint that this is like 4 months after his conviction, that him and another guy named Spencer Carrico were out poaching elk. Mm-hmm. So we shimmy up to Dubois, go to Grove's new house, and he's not home, but there's a deer leg sticking out of the shed there, a fresh deer leg. And this guy's not supposed to be hunting, right? So what's a deer leg doing in the shed?
Right.
So, long story short, Grove and this guy Carrico are out driving around the roads in Dubois hunting deer and hunting elk. And the Carrico has no licenses to do any of this. He ends up shooting a deer, takes it to Grove's house. Grove's driving his truck, transports it, helps him butcher it. And then they're shooting that elk too with no permits. And when we're there wanting to talk to him about this, we pulled back because they weren't home and we parked down the street. They showed up and both of them go in the house. We go knock on the door and they won't answer because they see the game wardens are outside the door.
Right. So
we knew Carrico was a younger guy, so we just called his mom.
mom pulled his hair and pulled his ear and he came out.
Pretty much he agreed to come back home and we were waiting for him at his mother's house.
Nice.
And he was a reluctant suspect. He didn't want to tell us anything about Grove, but by the end of the interview, he had confessed that him and Grove were out poaching wildlife while Grove was on revocation. And long story short, after that, since Grove was on probation, we waited till the state finished their prosecution in state court for the deer violation, and that documented that Grove had busted his probation federal court. The judge had seen Grove a number of times over the years, so the state sentenced him to 1 year in jail. So he went to jail, and the federal judge tacked on an extra 6 months. So Kelly Grove went to prison. I want to say this about it in closing, Ed.
You know,
when people cooperate with us, especially at great risks to themselves,
right,
it's a pretty scary proposition when you have to stand up against a community or even with friends or coworkers. So the people who risked the most in this case, I submitted them for a reward under the Lacey Act to give
nice.
Them some, and under ESA to give them some kind of financial thanks for helping us. And I think it went a long way.
Good for you. So, yeah, good for you. There are rewards available for some of these things under the Lacey Act. It's available. There's a Lacey Act reward account that allows Fish and Wildlife to give out rewards for information. So good for you for making sure that happened.
And in closing, you know, this was one bear. And you and I were talking in the beginning about the bear population. And we in law enforcement operate in the realm of individual victims, whereas biology might operate in the realm of a population. And what's tough about our jobs, and I'm sure you feel this way, I miss that mission of protecting wildlife.
Yep.
And I know even after I left that grizzly bears are still taking it on the chin by certain people.
Yep.
And all wildlife is. And to the men and women who are still out there doing it, you know, I want to cheer them on from my retirement seat, but I do miss that mission. More importantly, I miss the satisfaction of avenging like the death of that bear. So even though it was one.
Yep. No, and it is one bear, but the deterrent impact you had in being so diligent about pursuing the case and ultimately, you know, getting your man, it has a deterrent impact, which has the potential to save future bears. So, yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And I miss it too. I miss it every day because I loved protecting natural resources and I loved pursuing people that just kind of wantonly broke the law. You know, it drove me insane that there were, I don't like criminals. And I liked being the guy that put an end to criminal behavior. And I know you did too. And it's 10 times more satisfying when you're doing it to protect wildlife resources and natural resources for the entire population of the United States and the world. So that's pretty cool. I will say, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, you know, of course, just like any workplace, there are people that are superstars and average, but for the most part in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, special agents are extremely tenacious. And if you commit a wildlife crime, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service agents will pursue you, they will catch you, and they will put you in jail.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that. Grove's lawyer in that proffer at the end of his post-conviction, she had made some comment to that effect of, why did it take you guys so long to do this? And the U.S. attorney that was handling the case, he's now a judge here in town, and he kind of let her have it. He said, you know, you really think that we wanted to drag this case out for this long?
Yep.
What about the actions of your clients? Don't even try and sell that here. So, and lastly, I wanted, and everything you said is exactly right, Ed. And the last thing I want to say is that none of this stuff gets done by one individual agent.
No.
I can't say enough good about the state officers, you know, Scott Browning, Brian Baker, Brian DeBolt, the officers that came and helped with the takedown, the other agents who ventured over, Bo Stone, that helped put this together. And then without a good U.S. attorney who cares about wildlife, you know, it got done because we had good people helping too. So my thanks to all of them for doing what they did for grizzly bears. So.
Yeah. 100%.
And all the other wildlife. So.
Yeah. And there are more cases for you and I to talk about on future episodes. Steve, thank you so much for sharing your experience on this case. Great job on it, as with all the work that you do. I loved hearing about it, and I'm sure our listeners will too. Controversial, hard topic to talk about sometimes, but I think, and I know you agree, super important that predators exist in the Western U.S. And like you, I was proud to protect them through the federal laws that are available. So thanks again for being on the episode. I really appreciate it.
And Ed, thanks for having me, and thanks for hearing this story and putting it out there for people to hear it. So thanks.
You bet. All right. That'll do it for this episode of Nature's Secret Service. If you want to learn more about the Barber Point grizzly bear case or Steve's career, you can go to the Nature's Secret Service website. There will be some documents and photos posted there for you to take a look at, as well as you can listen to this episode right off the website. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you next time. Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturessecretservice.com.